board broke halfway through, I said stiffly. I wasn't working under ideal circumstances. Arwill was silent for a while, stroking his upper lip with a finger as he watched me through half-lidded eyes.
And do you enjoy this sort of thing?
He asked dubiously. I laughed at his expression, but it was cut short when dull pain blossomed across my back. No, Master, I was just taking care of myself as best I could. He continued looking at me, still stroking his lower lip.
Show me where the gut broke,
I pointed. It isn't the sort of thing that you forget. He gave the old scar a closer examination and prodded it again before looking up.
You may be telling the truth,
he shrugged.
I do not know, but I would think that if...
He trailed off and peered speculatively into my eyes. Reaching up, he pulled one of the lids back.
Look up,
he said perfunctorily. Frowning at whatever he saw, Arwill picked up one of my hands, pressed the tip of my fingernail firmly, and watched intently for a second or two. His frown deepened as he moved closer to me, took hold of my chin with one hand, opened my mouth and smelled it.
Tennyson?
He asked, then answered his own question.
No, Nelroot, of course. I must be getting old to not notice it sooner. It also explains why you're not bleeding all over my nice clean table.
He gave me a serious look.
How much?
I didn't see any way of denying it. 2 scruples. Arwill was silent for a while as he looked at me. After a moment, he removed his spectacles and rubbed them fiercely against his cuff. Replacing them, he looked straight at me.
It is no surprise that a boy might fear a whipping enough to drug himself for it.
He looked sharply at me.
But why, if he was so afraid, would he remove his shirt beforehand?
He frowned again.
You will explain all of this to me. If you've lied to me before, admit it, and all will be well. I know boys tell foolish stories sometimes.
His eyes glittered behind the glass of his spectacles.
But if you lie to me now, neither I nor any of mine will stitch you. I will not be lied to.
He crossed his arms in front of himself.
So, explain. I do not understand what is going on here. That, more than anything else, I do not like.
My last resort, then. The truth. My teacher, Abenthy, taught me as much as he could about the Physica's arts, I explained. When I ended up living on the streets of Tarbin, I took care of myself. I gestured to my knee. I didn't wear my shirt today because I only have 2 shirts, and it has been a long time since I've had as many as that.
And the Nalwood?
He asked. I sighed. I don't fit in here, sir. I'm younger than everyone, and a lot of people think I don't belong. I upset a lot of students by getting into the Arcanum so quickly, and I've managed to get on the wrong side of Master Hemme. All those students, and Hemme, and his friends, they're all watching me, waiting for some sign of weakness. I took a deep breath. I took the Nell route because I didn't want to faint. I needed to let them know they couldn't hurt me. I've learned that the best way to stay safe is to make your enemies think you can't be hurt. It sounded ugly to say it so starkly, but it was the truth. I looked at him defiantly. There was a long silence as Arwill looked at me, his eyes narrowing slightly behind his spectacles, as if he were trying to see something inside me. He brushed his upper lip with his finger again before he began slowly to speak.
I suppose, if I were older,
he said, quietly enough to be speaking to himself,
I would say that you were being ridiculous, that our students are adults, not squabbling, bickersome boys.
He paused again, still stroking his lip absent-mindedly. Then his eyes crinkled upward around the edges as he smiled at me.
But I am not so old as that. Not yet. Not by half. Anyone who thinks boys are innocent and sweet has never been a boy himself or has forgotten it. And anyone who thinks men aren't hurtful and cruel at times must not leave his house often. And he has certainly never been a Physica. We see the effects of cruelty more than any other.
Before I could respond, he said,
Close your mouth, Elliot Quilth, or I will feel obliged to put some vile tonic in it. Ah, here they come.
The last was said to 2 students entering the room, One was the same assistant who had shown me here. The other was, surprisingly, a young woman.
Ah, Leila Mala,
Arwill enthused, all signs of our serious discussion passing lightly from his face.
You have heard that your patient has 2 straight clean lacerations. What have you brought to remedy the situation?
Boiled linen, hook needle, gut, alcohol, and iodine, she said crisply.
She had green eyes that stood out in her pale face.
What?
Arwill demanded.
No sympathy wax?
No, Master Arwill, she responded, paling a little at his tone.
And why not?
She hesitated.
Because I don't need it.
Arwill seemed mollified.
Yes, of course you don't. Very good. Did you wash before you came here?
Mola nodded, her short blonde hair bobbing with the motion of her head.
Then you have wasted your time and effort, he said sternly. Think of all the germs of disease that you might have gathered in the long walk through the passageway. Wash again, and we will begin.
She washed with a thorough briskness at a nearby basin. Arwill helped me lay face down on the table.
Has the patient been numbed?
She asked. Though I couldn't see her face, I heard a shadow of doubt in her voice.
Anesthetized,
Arwill corrected.
You have a good eye for detail, Mola. No, he has not. Now, what would you do if Eliacroth reassured you that he has no need for such things? He claims to have self-control like a bar of Ramsden steel and will not flinch when you stitch him.
Arwill's tone was serious, but I could detect a hint of amusement hiding underneath. Mola looked at me, then back to Arwill.
I would tell him that he was being foolish, she said after a brief pause.
And if he persisted in his claims that he needed no numbing agent?
There was a longer pause from Mola.
He doesn't seem to be bleeding much at all, so I would proceed. I would also make it clear to him that if he moved over much, I would tie him to the table and treat him as I saw fit for his well-being.
Arwill seemed a little surprised at her response.
Yes, very good. So, Kroth, do you still wish to forego an anaesthetic?
Thank you, I said politely. I do not need one.
Very well,
Mola said, as if resigning herself.
First, we will clean and sterilize the wound.
The alcohol stung, but that was the worst of it. I tried my best to relax as Mola talked her way through the procedure. Arwill kept up a steady stream of comments and advice. I occupied my mind with other things and tried not to twitch at the gnarled root dulled jabs of the needle. She finished quickly and proceeded to bandage me with the quick efficiency I admired. As she helped me to a sitting position and wound linen around me, I wondered if all Arwill students were as well trained as this one. She was making her final knots behind me when I felt a vague, feather-like touch on my shoulder, almost insensible through the gnarl root that numbed me.
He has lovely skin,
I heard her muse, presumably to Arwill.
Vela,
Arwill said severely.
Such comments are not professional. I am disappointed by your lack of sense.
I was referring to the nature of the scar he can expect to have, she responded scathingly. I imagine it will be little more than a pale line, provided he can avoid tearing open his wound.
Arwill said. Yes, of course. And how should he avoid that?
Mola walked around to stand in front of me.
Avoid motions like this?
She extended her hands in front of her.
Or this?
She held them high over her head.
Avoid over-quick motions of any kind, running, jumping, climbing. The bandage may come off in 2 days. Do not get it wet.
She looked away from me, to Arwill. He nodded.
Very good, Rayla. You are dismissed.
He looked at the younger boy who had watched mutely throughout the procedure.
You may go as well, Gary. If anyone asks, I will be in my study. Thank you.
In a moment, Arwill and I were alone again. He stood motionless, one hand covering his mouth as I eased my way carefully into my shirt. Finally, he seemed to reach a decision.
Eliacroth, would you like to study here at the Medica?
Very much so, Master Arwill, I said honestly. He nodded to himself, hand still held against his lips.
Come back in 4 days. If you are clever enough to keep from tearing out your stitches, I will have you here.
His eyes twinkled.
Chapter 43 The Flickering Way. Buoyed by the stimulant effects of the Nalroot and feeling very little pain, I made my way to the archives. Since I was now a member of the Arcanum, I was free to explore the stacks, something I'd been waiting my whole life to do. Better still, so long as I didn't ask for any help from the Scrivs, nothing would be recorded in the archives' ledger books. That meant I could research the Chandrian and the Amir to my heart's content, and no one, not even Lauren, need ever know about my childish pursuits. Entering the reddish light of the archives, I found both Ambrose and Fela sitting behind the entry desk. A mixed blessing, if ever there was one. Ambrose was leaning towards her, speaking in a low voice. She had the distinctly uncomfortable look of a woman who knows the futility of a polite refusal. One of his hands rested on her knee, while the other arm was draped across the back of her chair, his hand resting on her neck. He meant for it to look tender and affectionate, but there was a tension in her body like that of a startled deer. The truth was, he was holding her there, the same way you hold a dog by the scruff of its neck to keep it from running off. As the door thumped closed behind me, Fela looked up, met my eyes, then looked down and away, ashamed by her predicament. As if she'd done anything. I'd seen that look too many times on the streets of Tarbin. It sparked an old anger in me. I approached the desk, making more noise than necessary. Pen and ink lay on the other end of the desk, and a piece of paper three-quarters full of rewriting and crossing out. From the looks of things, Ambrose had been trying to compose a poem. I reached the edge of the desk and stood for a moment. Fela looked everywhere except at me or Ambrose. She shifted in her seat, uncomfortable but obviously not wanting to make a scene. I cleared my throat pointedly. Ambrose looked over his shoulder, scowling.
"You have damnable timing, Elia. Come back later."
He turned away again, dismissing me. I snorted and leaned over the desk, craning my neck to look at the sheet of paper he'd left lying there.
"I have damnable timing? Please, you have 13 syllables in a line here."
I tapped a finger onto the page.
"It's not iambic either. I don't know if it's anything metrical at all."
He turned to look at me again, his expression irritated.
"Mind your tongue, Elia. The day I come to you for help with poetry is the day."
"Is the day you have 2 hours to spare," I said. "Two long hours, and that's just for getting started. So same can the humble thrush well know its north? I mean, I don't even know how to begin to criticize that. It practically mocks itself."
"What do you know of poetry?"
Ambrose said without bothering to turn around.
"I know a limping verse when I hear it," I said. "But this isn't even limping. A limp has rhythm. This is more like someone falling down a set of stairs, uneven stairs, with a midden at the bottom."
"It is a sprung rhythm," he said, his voice stiff and offended. "I wouldn't expect you to understand."
"Sprung?"
I burst out with an incredulous laugh.
"Ha! I understand that if I saw a horse with a leg this badly sprung, I'd kill it out of mercy, then burn its poor corpse for fear the local dogs might gnaw on it and die."
Ambrose finally turned around to face me, and in so doing, he had to take his right hand off Fela's knee. A half victory. But his other hand remained on her neck, holding her in her chair with the appearance of a casual caress.
"I thought you might stop by today," he said with a brittle cheerfulness. "So I already checked the ledger. You're not in the lists yet. You'll have to stick with tomes or come back later, after they've updated the books."
"No offense, but would you mind checking again? I'm not sure I can trust the literacy of someone who tries to rhyme north with worth. No wonder you have to hold women down to get them to listen to it."
Ambrose stiffened, and his arm slid off the back of the chair to fall at his side. His expression was pure venom.
"When you're older, Elia, you'll understand that what a man and a woman do together..."
"Whoa!
What? In the privacy of the entrance hall of the archives?
I gestured around us.
God's body, this isn't some brothel, and in case you hadn't noticed, she's a student, not some brass nail you've paid to bang away at. If you're going to force yourself on a woman, have the decency to do it in an alleyway. At least that way she'll feel justified screaming about it.
Ambrose's face flushed furiously, and it took him a long moment to find his voice.
You don't know the first thing about women.
There, at least, we can agree, I said easily. In fact, that's the reason I came here today. I wanted to do some research, find a book or two on the subject.
I struck the ledger with two fingers, hard.
So look up my name and let me in.
Ambrose flipped the book open, found the proper page, and turned the book around to face me.
There! You can find your name on that list. You're welcome to peruse the stacks at your leisure.
He gave a tight smile.
Otherwise, feel free to come back in a span or so. We should have things updated by then.
I had the master send along a note just in case there was any confusion about my admission to the Arcanum, I said, and drew my shirt up over my head, turning so he could see the broad expanse of bandages covering my back. Can you read it from there? Or do I need to come closer?
There was a pointed silence from Ambrose, so I lowered my shirt and turned to face Fela, ignoring him entirely.
My Lady Scriv, I said to her with a bow, a very slight bow as my back wouldn't permit a deep one. Would you be so good as to help me locate a book concerning women? I've been instructed by my betters to inform myself on this most subtle subject.
Fela gave a faint smile and relaxed a bit. She had continued sitting stiff and uncomfortable after Ambrose had taken his hand away. I guessed that she knew Ambrose's temperament well enough to know that if she bolted away and embarrassed him, he would make her pay for it later.
I don't know if we have anything like that. I would settle for a primer, I said with a smile. I have it on good report that I don't know the first thing about them, so anything would further my knowledge.
Something with pictures?
Ambrose spat.
If our search degenerates to that level, I'll be sure to call on you, I said without looking in his direction.
I smiled at Fela.
Perhaps a bestiary, I said gently. I hear they are singular creatures, much different than men.
Fela's smile blossomed, and she gave a small laugh.
We could have a look around, I suppose.
Ambrose scowled in her direction. She made a placating gesture towards him.
Everyone knows he's in the Arcanum, Ambrose, she said. What's the harm of just letting him in?
Ambrose glared at her.
Why don't you run along to Tomes and play the good little fetch and carry girl? He said coldly. I can handle things out here by myself.
Moving stiffly, Fela got up from the desk, gathered up the book she'd been trying to read, and headed into Tomes. As she pulled the door open, I like to think she gave me a brief look of gratitude and relief, but perhaps it was only my imagination. As the door swung shut behind her, the room seemed to grow a little dimmer. I'm not speaking poetically. The light truly seemed to dim. I looked at the sympathy lamps hanging around the room, wondering what was wrong. But a moment later, I felt a slow, burning sensation begin to creep across my back and realized the truth. The null root was wearing off. Most powerful painkillers have serious side effects. Tenosin occasionally produces delirium or fainting. Lacillium is poisonous. Ofolum is highly addictive. Menka is perhaps the most powerful of all, but there are reasons they call it devil root. Null root was less powerful than these, but much safer. It was a mild anesthetic, a stimulant, and a vascular constrictor, which is why I hadn't bled like a stuck pig when they'd whipped me. Best of all, it had no major side effects. Still, there was always a price to be paid. Once null root wears off, it leaves you physically and mentally exhausted. Regardless, I had come here to see the stacks. I was now a member of the Arcanum, and I didn't intend to leave until I'd been inside the archives. I turned back to the desk, my expression resolute. Ambrose gave me a long, calculating look before heaving a sigh.
Fine, he said. How about a deal? You keep quiet about what you saw here today, and I'll bend the rules and let you in, even though you aren't officially in the book.
He looked a little nervous.
How does that sound?
Even as he spoke, I could feel the stimulant effect from the gnarl root fading. My body felt heavy and tired. My thoughts grew sluggish and syrupy. I reached up to rub at my face with my hands and winced as the motion tugged sharply at the stitches all across my back.
That'll be fine, I said thickly.
Ambrose opened up one of the ledger books and sighed as he turned the pages.
Since this is your first time in the archives proper, you'll have to pay the stack fee.
My mouth tasted strangely of lemons. That was a side effect Ben had never mentioned. It was distracting, and after a moment I saw that Ambrose was looking up at me expectantly.
What?
He gave me a strange look.
The stack fee.
There wasn't any fee before, I said, when I was in the tomes. Ambrose looked up at me as if I were an idiot.
That's because it's the stack fee.
He looked back down at the ledger.
Normally, you pay it in addition to your first term's Arcanum tuition, but since you've jumped rank on us, you'll need to tend to it now.
How much is it? I asked, feeling for my purse.
One talent,
he said,
and you do have to pay before you can go in. Rules are rules.
After paying for my bunk in Muse, a talent was nearly all my remaining money. I was keenly aware of the fact that I needed to hoard my resources to save for next term's tuition. As soon as I couldn't pay, I would have to leave the university. Still, it was a small price to pay for something I'd dreamed about for most of my life. I pulled a talent out of my purse and handed it over. Do I need to sign in?
Nothing so formal as that,
Ambrose said as he opened a drawer and pulled out a small metal disc. Stupefied from the side effects of the gnarl root, it took me a moment to recognize it for what it was, a hand-held sympathy lamp.
The stacks aren't lit,
Ambrose said matter-of-factly.
There's too much space in there, and it would be bad for the books in the long term. Hand lamps cost a talent and a half.
I hesitated. Ambrose nodded to himself and looked thoughtful.
A lot of folk end up strapped during first term.
He reached down into a lower drawer and rooted around for a long moment.
Hand lamps are a talent and a half, and there's nothing I can do about that.
He brought out a 4-inch taper.
But candles are just a halfpenny.
Halfpenny for a candle was a remarkably good deal. I brought out a penny.
I'll take two.
This is our last one,
Ambrose said quickly. He looked around nervously before pushing it into my hand.
Tell you what, you could have it for free.
He smiled.
Just don't tell anyone. It'll be our little secret.
I took the candle, more than a little surprised. Apparently I'd frightened him with my idle threat earlier. Either that, or this rude, pompous, noble son wasn't half the bastard I'd taken him for. Ambrose hurried me into the stacks as quickly as possible, leaving me no time to light my candle. When the doors swung shut behind me, it was as black as the inside of a sack, with only a faint hint of reddish sympathy light coming around the edges of the door behind me. As I didn't have any matches with me, I had to resort to sympathy. Ordinarily, I could have done it quick as blinking, but my gnarl root weary mind could barely muster the necessary concentration. I gritted my teeth, fixed the alar in my mind, and after a few seconds, I felt the cold leach into my muscles as I drew enough heat from my own body to bring the wick of the candle sputtering to life. Books. With no windows to let in the sunlight, the stacks were utterly dark except for the gentle light of my candle. Stretching away into the darkness were shelf on shelf of books, more books than I could look at if I took a whole day, more books than I could read in a lifetime. The air was cool and dry. It smelled of old leather, parchment, and forgotten secrets. I wondered idly how they kept the air so fresh in a building with no windows. Cupping a hand in front of my candle, I made my flickering way through the shelves, savoring the moment, soaking everything in. Shadows danced wildly back and forth across the ceiling as my candle's flame moved from side to side. The null root had worn off completely by this point. My back was throbbing and my thoughts were leaden, as if I had a high fever or had taken a hard blow to the back of the head. I knew I wasn't going to be up for a long bout of reading, but I still couldn't bring myself to leave so soon. Not after everything I'd gone through to get here. I wandered aimlessly for perhaps a quarter of an hour, exploring. I discovered several small stone rooms with heavy wooden doors and tables inside. They were obviously meant as a place where small groups could meet and talk without disturbing the perfect quiet of the archives. I found stairwells leading down as well as up. The archives were 6 stories tall, but I hadn't known it extended underground as well. How deep did it go? How many tens of thousands of books were waiting under my feet? I can hardly describe how comforting it was in the cool, quiet dark. I was perfectly content, lost among the endless books. It made me feel safe, knowing that the answers to all my questions were here, somewhere, waiting. It was quite by accident that I found the 4-plate door. It was made of a solid piece of grey stone, the same colour as the surrounding walls. Its frame was 8 inches wide, also grey, and also one single seamless piece of stone. The door and frame fit together so tightly that a pin couldn't slide into the crack. It had no hinges, no handle, no window or sliding panel. Its only features were 4 hard copper plates. They were set flush with the face of the door, which was flush with the front of the frame, which was flush with the wall surrounding it. You could run your hand from one side of the door to the next and hardly feel the lines of it at all. In spite of these notable lacks, the expanse of grey stone was undoubtedly a door. It simply was. Each copper plate had a hole in its centre, and though they were not shaped in the conventional way, they were undoubtedly keyholes. The door sat still as a mountain, quiet and indifferent as the sea on a windless day. This was not a door for opening, it was a door for staying closed. In its center, between the untarnished copper plates, a word was chiseled deep into the stone. Malaritas. There were other locked doors in the university, places where dangerous things were kept, where old and forgotten secrets slept, silent and hidden. Doors whose opening was forbidden, doors whose thresholds no one crossed, whose keys had been destroyed or lost, or locked away themselves for safety's sake. But they all paled in comparison to the 4-plate door. I lay my palm on the cool, smooth face of the door and pushed, hoping against hope that it might swing open to my touch. But it was solid and unmoving as a greystone. I tried to peer through the holes in the copper plates, but couldn't see anything by the light of my single candle. I wanted to get inside so badly I could taste it. Probably shows a perverse element of my personality that even though I was finally inside the archives, surrounded by endless secrets, that I was drawn to the one locked door I had found. Perhaps it is human nature to seek out hidden things. Perhaps it is simply my nature. Just then, I saw the red, unwavering light of a sympathy lamp approaching through the shelves. It was the first sign I'd seen of any other students in the archives. I took a step back and waited, thinking to ask whoever was coming what was behind the door, what Valaritas meant. The red light swelled, and I saw 2 scrivs turn a corner. They paused, then one of them bolted to where I stood and snatched my candle away, spilling hot wax on my hand in the process of extinguishing it. His expression couldn't have been more horrified if he had found me carrying a freshly severed head. "What are you doing with an open flame in here?"
he demanded in the loudest whisper I had ever heard. He lowered his voice and waved the now extinguished candle at me.
Sharp body of God, what's the matter with you?
I rubbed at the hot wax on the back of my hand, trying to think clearly through the fog of pain and exhaustion. Of course, I thought, remembering Ambrose's smile as he pressed the candle into my hands and hurried me through the door. Our little secret. Of course I should have known. One of the scrivs led me out of the stacks while the other ran to fetch Master Lauren. When we emerged into the entryway, Ambrose managed to look confused and shocked. He overacted the part, but it was convincing enough for the scriv accompanying me.
What's he doing in here?
We found him wandering around, the scriv explained, with a candle.
What?
Ambrose's expression was perfectly aghast.
Well, I didn't sign him in,
Ambrose said. He flipped open one of the ledger books.
Look, see for yourself.
Before anything else could be said, Lauren stormed into the room. His normally placid expression was fierce and hard. I felt myself sweat cold, and I thought of what Tekam wrote in his Theophany. There are three things all wise men fear: the sea in storm, a night with no moon, and the anger of a gentle man. Lauren towered over the entry desk.
Explain!
He demanded of the nearby scriv. His voice was a tight coil of fury.
Micah and I saw a flickering light in the stacks, and we went to see if someone was having trouble with their lamp. We found him near the southeast stairwell with this.
The scriv held up the candle. His hand shook slightly under Lauren's glare. Lauren turned to the desk where Ambrose sat.
How did this happen, Rayla?
Ambrose raised his hands helplessly.
He came in earlier, and I wouldn't admit him because he wasn't in the book. We bickered for a while. Fela was here for most of it.
He looked at me.
Eventually I told him he'd have to leave. He must have snuck in when I went into the back room for more ink.
Ambrose shrugged.
Or maybe he slipped in past the desk in tomes.
I stood there, stupefied. What little part of my mind wasn't leaden with fatigue was preoccupied with the screaming pain across my back.
That's not true.
I looked up at Lauren.
He let me in. He sent Fela away, then let me in.
What?
Ambrose gaped at me, momentarily speechless. For all that I didn't like him, I must give him credit for a masterful performance.
Why in God's name would I do that?
Because I embarrassed you in front of Fela,
I said.
He sold me the candle, too.
I shook my head, trying to clear my head.
No, he gave it to me.
Ambrose's expression was amazed.
Look at him,
he laughed.
The little cocker is drunk or something.
I was just whipped,
I protested. My voice sounded shrill in my own ears.
Enough!
Lauren shouted, looming over us like a pillar of anger. The scrivs went pale at the sound of him. Lauren turned away from me and made a brief contemptuous gesture towards the desk.
Raylord Ambrose is officially remanded for laxity in his duty.
What?
Ambrose's indignant tone wasn't feigned this time. Lauren frowned at him, and Ambrose closed his mouth. Turning to me, he said,
Elia Quoth is banned from the archives.
He made a sweeping gesture with the flat of his hand. I tried to think of something I could say in my defense.
Master, I didn't mean...
Lauren rounded on me. His expression, always so calm before, was filled with such a cold, terrible anger that I took a step away from him without meaning to.
You mean,
he said,
I care nothing for your intentions, Elia Quoth. Deceived or otherwise, all that matters is the reality of your actions. Your hand held the fire, yours is the blame. That is the lesson all adults must learn.
I looked down at my feet, tried desperately to think of something I could say, some proof I could offer. My leaden thoughts were still plodding along when Lauren strode out of the room.
I don't see why I should be punished for his stupidity,
Ambrose groused to the other scrivs as I made my way numbly to the door. I made the mistake of turning around and looking at him. His expression was serious,
carefully controlled, but his eyes were vastly amused, full of laughter.
"Honestly, boy," he said to me, "I don't know what you were thinking. You'd think a member of the Arcanum would have more sense."
I made my way to the mess, the wheels of my thoughts turning slowly as I plodded along. I fumbled my meal chit into one of the dull tin trays and collected a portion of steamed pudding, a sausage, and some of the ever-present beans. I looked dully around the room until I spotted Simon and Manette sitting in their usual place at the northeast corner of the hall. I drew a fair amount of attention as I walked to the table, understandable as it was scarcely 2 hours since I'd been tied to the pennant pole and publicly lashed. I heard someone whisper, "Didn't bleed when they whipped him. I was there, not one drop." It was the Nalrut, of course. It had kept me from bleeding. It had seemed like such a good idea at the time. Now it seemed petty and foolish. Ambrose would never have managed to gull me so easily if my naturally suspicious nature hadn't been fuddled. I'm sure I could have found some way to explain things to Lauren if I'd had my wits about me. As I made my way to the far corner of the room, I realized the truth. I had traded away my access to the archives in exchange for a little notoriety. Still, there was nothing to do but make the best of it. If a bit of reputation was all I had to show for this debacle, I'd have to do my best to build on it. I kept my shoulders straight as I made my way across the room to Simon and Manette and set down my food.
"There's no such thing as a stack fee, is there?"
I asked quietly as I slid into my seat, trying not to grimace at the pain across my back. Sim looked at me blankly.
"Stack fee?"
Manette chortled into his bowl of beans.
"It's been a few years since I heard that. Back when I worked as a scriv, we tricked the first-termers into giving us a penny to use the archives. Called it a stack fee."
Sim gave him a disapproving look.
"That's horrible."
Manette held up his hands defensively in front of his face.
"Just a little harmless fun."
Manette looked me over.
"Is that what your long face is for? Somebody call you for a copper?"
I shook my head. I wasn't going to announce that Ambrose had tricked me out of a whole talent.
"Guess who just got banned from the archives?"
I said gravely, as I tore the crust off my bread and dropped it into my beans. They looked at me blankly. After a moment, Simon took the obvious guess.
You?
I nodded and began to spoon up my beans. I wasn't really hungry, but I hoped a little food in my stomach might help shake off the sluggishness of the Nalrut. Besides, it went against my nature to pass up an opportunity for a meal.
"You got suspended on your first day," Simon said. "That's going to make studying your Chandrian folklore a whole lot harder."
I sighed.
"You can say that."
"How long did he suspend you for?"
"He said banned," I answered. "He didn't mention a time limit."
"Banned?"
Manette looked up at me.
"He hasn't banned anyone in a dozen years. What do? Piss in a book?"
"Some of the skiffs found me inside with a candle."
"Merciful Tselu!"
Manette laid down his fork, his expression serious for the first time.
"Oh, Law must have been furious."
"Furious is exactly the right word," I said.
"What possessed you to go in there with an open flame?"
Simon asked.
"I couldn't afford a hand lamp," I said. "So the scriv at the desk gave me a candle instead."
"He didn't,"
Sim said.
"No scriv would."
"Hold on,"
Manette said.
"Was this a dark-haired fellow, well-dressed, severe eyebrows?"
He made an exaggerated scowl. I nodded tiredly.
"Ambrose. We met yesterday, got off on the wrong foot."
"He's hard to avoid,"
Manette said carefully, with a significant look to the people sitting around us. I noticed that more than a few were casually listening to our conversation.
"Someone should have warned you to keep clear of him,"
he added in a softer tone.
"God's mother,"
Simon said.
"Of all the people you don't want to start a pissing contest with."
"Well, it's been started," I said. I was starting to feel a little more like myself again, less cotton-headed and weary. Either the side effects of the gnarl root were fading, or my anger was slowly burning away the haze of exhaustion. He'll find out I can piss along with the best of them. He'll wish he'd never met me, let alone meddled with my affairs. Simon looked a little nervous.
You really shouldn't threaten other students,
he said with a little laugh, as if trying to pass my comment off as a joke. More softly, he said,
You don't understand. Ambrose is heir to a barony off in Vinters.
He hesitated, looking to Manet.
Lord, how do I even start?
Manet leaned forward and spoke in more confidential tones as well.
He's not one of those nobility who dabble here for a term or two, then leave. He's been here for years, climbed his way up to Raylar. He's not some seventh son, either. He's the first-born heir, and his father is one of the 12 most powerful men in all of Vinters. Actually, he's 16th in the peerage, Sim said matter-of-factly. You've got the royal family, the prince regents, Mayor Alvaron, Duchess Semester, Aculeus, and Meluin Laclus.
He trailed off under Manet's glare.
He has money, Manet said simply, and the friends that money buys, and people who want to curry favour with his father, Simon added. The point is, Manet said seriously, you don't want to cross him. Back in his first year here, one of the alchemists got on Ambrose's bad side. Ambrose bought his debt from the moneylender in Imre. When the fellow couldn't pay, they clapped him into debtor's prison.
Manet tore a piece of bread in half and daubed butter onto it.
By the time his family got him out, he had lung consumption. Fellow was a wreck. Never came back to his studies.
And the masters just let this happen?
I demanded.
All perfectly legal, Manet said, still keeping his voice low. Even so, Ambrose wasn't so silly that he bought the fellow's debt himself.
Manet made a dismissive gesture.
He had someone else do that, but he made sure everyone knew he was responsible.
And there was Tabitha, Sim said darkly. She made all that noise about how Ambrose had promised to marry her. She just disappeared.
This certainly explained why Fela had been so hesitant to offend him. I made a placating gesture to Sim.
I'm not threatening anyone,
I said innocently, pitching my voice so anyone who was listening could easily hear.
I'm just quoting one of my favourite pieces of literature. It's from the fourth act of Dionica, where Tarsus says, Upon him I will visit famine and a fire, till all around him desolation rings, and all the demons in the outer dark look on amazed, and recognize that vengeance is the business of a man.
There was a moment of stunned silence nearby. It spread a bit farther through the mess than I'd expected. Apparently, I'd underestimated the number of people who were listening. I turned my attention back to my meal and decided to let it go for now. I was tired, and I hurt, and I didn't particularly want any more trouble today.
You won't need this piece of information for a while,
Manet said quietly after a long period of silence.
What with being banned from the archives and all. Still, I'm supposing you'd rather know.
He cleared his throat uncomfortably.
You don't have to buy a hand lamp. You just sign them out at the desk and return them when you're done.
He looked at me as if anxious about what sort of reaction the information might provoke. I nodded wearily. I'd been right before. Ambrose wasn't half the bastard I thought he was. He was 10 times the bastard.
Chapter 44 The Burning Glass. The fishery was where most of the university's works of hands were made. The building held shops for glassblowers, joiners, potters and glaziers. There was also a full forge and smelt works that would figure prominently in any metallurgist's daydreams. Kilvin's workshop was located in the artificery, or as it was more commonly called, the fishery. It was big as the inside of a granary,
holding at least 24 thick timbered work tables strewn with countless nameless tools and projects in progress. The workshop was the heart of the fishery, and Kilvin was the heart of the workshop. When I arrived, Kilvin was in the process of bending a twisted length of iron rod into what I could only assume was a more desirable shape. Seeing me peering in, he left it firmly clamped to the table and walked to meet me, wiping his hands on his shirt. He looked me over critically.
"Are you well, Elir Quoth?"
I'd gone wandering earlier and found some willow bark to chew. My back still burned and itched, but it was bearable.
"Well enough, Master Kilvin,"
he nodded.
"Good. Boys your age shouldn't worry over such small things. Soon again you will be as sound as stone."
I was trying to think up a polite response when my eye was drawn to something over our heads. Kilvin followed my gaze up over his shoulder. When he saw what I was looking at, a grin split his great bearded face.
"Ah!"
he said with fatherly pride.
"My lovelies!"
High among the high rafters of the workshop, a 500 glass spheres hung from chains. They were of varying sizes, though none were much larger than a man's head, and they were burning. Seeing my expression, Kilvin made a gesture.
"Come,"
he said, and led me to a narrow stairway made of wrought iron. Reaching the top, we stepped out onto a series of slim iron walkways 25 feet above the ground, weaving their way among the thick timbers that supported the roof. After a moment of maneuvering through the maze of timber and iron, we came to the hanging row of glass spheres with fires burning inside them.
"These,"
Kilvin gestured,
"are my lamps."
It was only then that I realized what they were. Some were filled with liquid and wicking, much like ordinary lamps, but most of them were utterly unfamiliar. One contained nothing but a boiling grey smoke that flickered sporadically. Another sphere contained a wick hanging in empty air from a silver wire, burning with a motionless white flame, despite its apparent lack of fuel. Two hanging side by side were twins, save that one had a blue flame, and the other was a hot forge orange. Some were small as plums, others as large as melons. One held what looked like a piece of black coal and a piece of white chalk, and where the two pieces were pressed together, an angry red flame burned outward in all directions. Kilvin let me look for a long while before he moved closer.
"Among the Keeldar, there are legends of ever-burning lamps. I believe that such a thing was once within the scope of our craft. 10 years I have been looking. I have made many lamps, some of them very good, very long burning."
He looked at me.
"But none of them ever burning."
He walked down the line to point at one of the hanging spheres.
"Do you know this one, Elir Quoth?"
It held nothing but a knob of greenish-grayish wax that was burning with a greenish-grayish tongue of flame. I shook my head.
You should. White lithium salt. I thought of it 3 span before you came to us. It is good so far, 24 days, and I expect many more."
He looked at me.
"You're guessing. This thing surprised me, as it took me 10 years to think of it. Your second guess, sodium oil, was not as good. I tried it years ago, 11 days.
He moved all the way to the end of the row, pointing at the empty sphere with the motionless white flame.
70 days, he said proudly. "I do not hope that this will be the one, for hoping is a foolish game. But if it burns 6 more days, it will be my best lamp in these 10 years.
He watched it for a while, his expression oddly soft.
"But I do not hope," he said resolutely. "I make new lamps and take my measurements. That is the only way to make progress."
Wordlessly, he led me back down to the floor of the workshop. Once there, he turned to me.
"Hands,"
he said in a peremptory way. He held out his own huge hands expectantly. Not knowing what he wanted, I raised my hands in front of me. He took them in his own, his touch surprisingly gentle. He turned them over, looking at them carefully.
You have Kildar hands,
he said in a grudging compliment. He held his own up for me to see. They were thick-fingered with wide palms. He made two fists that looked more like mauls than bald hands.
I had many years before these hands could learn to be Kildar hands. You are lucky. You will work here.
Only by the quizzical tilting of his head did he make the gruff grumble of a statement into an invitation.
Oh, yes. I mean, thank you, sir. I'm honored that you...
He cut me off with an impatient gesture.
Come to me if you have any thoughts on the ever-burning lamp, if your head is as clever as your hands look.
What might have been a smile was hidden by his thick beard, but a grin shone in his dark eyes as he hesitated teasingly, almost playfully.
If,
he repeated, holding up a finger, its tip as large as the ball of a hammer's head.
Then me and mine will show you things.
You need to figure out who you're going to suck up to, Simon said. A master has to sponsor you to Raylar, so you should pick one and stick to him like shit on his shoe.
Lovely,
Savoy said dryly. Savoy, Willem, Simon and I were sitting at an out-of-the-way table in the back of Anchors, isolated from the Felling Knight crowd that filled the room with a low roar of conversation. My stitches had come out 2 days earlier, and we were celebrating my first full span in the Arcanum. We were none of us particularly drunk, but then again, none of us were particularly sober either. Our exact positioning between those two points is a matter of pointless conjecture, and I will waste no time on it.
I simply concentrate on being brilliant, Savoy said. Then wait for the masters to realize it.
Who did that work out with Mandrag?
Willem said with a rare smile. Savoy gave Willem a dark look.
Mandrag is a horse's ass.
That explains why you threatened him with your riding crop,
Willem said. I covered my mouth to stifle a laugh.
Did you really?
They're not telling the whole story,
Savoy said, affronted.
He passed me over for promotion in favor of another student. He was keeping me back so he could use me as indentured labor rather than raise me to Raylar.
And you threatened him with your crop?
We had an argument,
Savoy said calmly,
and I happened to have my crop in my hand.
You waved it at them,
Willem said.
I'd been riding,
Savoy said hotly.
If I'd been whoring before class and waved a corset at him, no one would have thought twice about it.
There was a moment of silence at our table.
I'm thinking twice about it right now, Simon said before bursting into laughter with Willem.
Savoy fought down a smile as he turned to face me.
Sim is right about one thing. You should concentrate your efforts on one subject, otherwise you'll end up like Manet, the eternal Elir.
He stood and straightened his clothes.
Now, how do I look?
Savoy wasn't fashionably dressed in the strictest sense, as he clung to the Madigan styles rather than the local ones, but there was no denying that he cut quite a figure in the muted colours of his fine silks and suedes.
What does it matter? Willem asked. Are you trying to set up a tryst with Sim?
Savoy smiled.
Unfortunately, I must leave you. I have an engagement with a lady, and I doubt our rounds will bring us to this side of town tonight.
You didn't tell us you had a date,
Sim protested.
We can't play corners with just three.
It was something of a concession that Savoy was here with us at all. He'd sniffed a bit at Will and Sim's choice of taverns. Anchors was low class enough so that the drinks were cheap, but high class enough so that you didn't have to worry about someone picking a fight or throwing up on you. I liked it.
You are good friends and good company, Savoy said, but none of you are female, nor, with the possible exception of Simon, are you lovely.
Savoy winked at him.
Honestly, who among you wouldn't throw the others over if there was a lady waiting?
We murmured a grudging agreement. Savoy smiled. His teeth were very white and straight.
I'll send the girl over with more drinks, he said as he turned to go, to ease the bitter sting of my departure.
He's not a bad sort, I mused after he left. For nobility. Willem nodded. It's like he knows he's better than you but doesn't look down on you for it because he knows it's not your fault.
So, who are you going to cozy up to?
Sim asked, resting his elbows on the table.
I'm guessing not Hemme.
Or Lauren, I said bitterly. Damn Ambrose, 12 ways. I would have loved to work in the archives.
Brandia's out too, Sim said. If Hemme has a grudge, Brandia helps him carry it.
What about the Chancellor? Willem asked. Linguistics. You already speak Siaru, even if your accent is barbaric.
I shook my head.
What about Mandrag?
I've got a lot of experience with chemistry. It'd be a small step into alchemy.
Simon laughed.
Everyone thinks chemistry and alchemy are so similar, but they're really not. They're not even related. They just happen to live in the same house.
Willem gave a slow nod.
That's a nice way of putting it. Besides, Simon said, Mandrag brought in about 20 new Elia last term. I heard him complaining about how crowded things were.
You've got a long haul if you go through Medica, Willem said. Arwill is stubborn as pig iron. There is no bending him.
He made a gesture with his hand as if chopping something into sections while he spoke.
6 terms, Elia. 8 terms, Raelar. 10 terms, Elthe.
At least, Simon added, Mola's been a Raelar with him for almost 3 years now. I tried to think of how I could come up with 6 years' worth of tuition.
I might not have the patience for that, I said.
The serving girl appeared with a tray of drinks. Anchor's was only half full, so she'd been running, just enough to bring roses to her cheeks.
Your gentleman friend paid for this round and the next, she said.
I like Savoy more and more, Willem said.
However,
she held Will's drink out of his reach,
he didn't pay for putting his hand on my arse.
She looked each of us in the eye.
I'll trust the three of you to settle that debt before you leave.
Sim stammered an apology.
He doesn't mean it. In his culture, that sort of thing is more common.
She rolled her eyes, her expression softening.
Well, in this culture, a healthy tip makes a fine apology.
She handed Will his drink and turned to leave, resting her empty tray on one hip. We watched her go, each of us thinking our own private thoughts.
I noticed he had his rings back, I mentioned eventually.
He played a brilliant round of Basset last night, Simon said, made 6 doublings in a row and cracked the bank.
To Savoy, Willem held up his tin mug. May his luck keep him in classes and us in drinks.
We toasted and drank, then Willem brought us back to the matter at hand.
That leaves you with Kelvin and
Elksadal. He held up 2 fingers.
What about Elodine?
I interrupted. They both gave me blank looks.
What about him?
Simon asked.
He seems nice enough, I said. Couldn't I study under him?
Simon burst out laughing. Willem gave a rare grin.
What?
I demanded.
Elodine doesn't teach anything, Sim explained, except maybe advanced oddness. He has to teach something, I protested. He's a master, isn't he?
Sim is right. Elodine is cramped.
Will tapped the side of his head.
Cracked.
Simon corrected.
Cracked,
Will repeated.
He does seem a little strange, I said.
You do pick things up quick, Willem said dryly. No wonder you made it into the Arcanum at such a tender age.
Ease off, Will, he's hardly been here a span.
Simon turned to me.
Elodine used to be Chancellor about 5 years ago.
Elodine?
I couldn't hide my incredulity.
But he's so young and...
I trailed off, not wanting to say the first word that came to my mind.
Crazy.
Simon finished my sentence.
Brilliant. And not that young if you consider that he was admitted to the university when he was barely 14.
Simon looked at me.
He was a full arcanist by 18. Then he stayed around as a giller for a few years.
Giller? I interrupted.
Gillers are arcanists who stay at the university, Will said. They do a lot of the teaching. You know Kamar in the fishery?
I shook my head.
Tall, scarred?
Will gestured to one side of his face.
Only one eye?
I nodded somberly. Kamar was hard to miss. The left side of his face was a web of scars that radiated out, leaving bald strips running through his black hair and beard. He wore a patch over the hollow of his left eye. He was a walking object lesson about how dangerous work in the fishery could be. I've seen him